Joined now in studio by a familiar face and a new face, Dr. Amy Chai, the independent candidate in the 3rd Congressional District, is here. Dr. Amy, great to see you.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
Also, our Green Party's candidate, Justin Paglino, is here. Although, Justin, I'm going to have a really hard time because I am Italian and I don't want to pronounce that G at all, but I'm going to do it for you. Thank you guys both for being here. As I mentioned, Rosa DeLauro was also invited to attend.
Where is she, Joe?
That's where I was hoping Eric was going to play the crickets, but we didn't do that in rehearsal. I just assumed. I don't think anybody knows where Rosa is at this point. Leslie DeNardis, the Republican candidate, was very interested in the idea of coming on and talking about the topic. So I'll give her that. Could not make it today, so she will be here tomorrow at 1:30. And just to be fair, I'm going to, whatever we ask you guys today, I'm going to make sure to ask Leslie tomorrow, just again, for the sake of fairness.
Great idea.
One of the things I'm not looking for, and you and I have talked about this, Dr. Amy, and I appreciate this. And Justin, you seem like a straight shooter.
Sure.
You do. You've got that face about you. I'm not into rhetoric. I'm not into talking points. And I'm not into how bad the other guy is. I want to hear what you're going to do and how you're going to fix the problems. And I would tell Rosa the same thing if she was here. And I will tell Leslie that tomorrow.
I never say how bad anyone is. I sometimes attack policies, though.
Yeah. And, well, listen.
Policies are fair policies,
game. Yes, yes. Failed policies are different. What somebody's hair color is doesn't matter.
No.
Right? I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah.
It's adorable. It's a lot of character. Anyway, all right, so let's get to it. As I mentioned, Dr. Amy's been here. One of the things we did talk about was the education system in the 3rd District in New Haven. The numbers are horrible. 17% grade 3 reading level. The math was only in the mid-20s.
12%, actually.
What's 12?
It was 12%.
The math was 12?
Yes, at grade level, yeah.
And the 17 was reading?
Reading, yeah.
Oh, boy. Hartford and Bridgeport, if I'm not mistaken, are in the 20s.
28% and 29% in
exactly
Hartford
right.
and Bridgeport.
We're failing our cities. The city kids are just, they're obviously not getting what they need to be getting. What are your thoughts, Justin, on education? What do we have to do? I mean, we've seen $42 million went into that school system. Nobody seems to know where the results are now.
Well, I believe in equality of education. That's foundational to equality of opportunity. And the system we have in place right now is one where the bigger a tax base a town has, the wealthier the residents, the more they can afford to spend on education. And that's just seems to me inherently inequitable and unjust. So I would favor a more state-based way of financing education to make sure that it's equitable across the state. And I think we know what models work for education. I favor public education. I don't think the profit motive belongs in education any more than it belongs in healthcare or prisons. So I'm not a fan of charter schools. I think that just takes money out of the public school system. I would like to see a reduction in property taxes and replace with progressive, and I think funding should come from a progressive income tax statewide. And we should rely on that more heavily for education. And then from a state perspective and a state view, try to do what we can to ensure that we're not that we are treating people equally and that there's equitable opportunities in every town or city.
Dr. Chai?
Well, I am concerned mostly not just with the funding of the school, but the way that the funds are actually used. And in New Haven City, we have a lot of schools that are beautiful, brand new schools, and we have a lot of cash going per child every year. The problem is it's just not producing the results. And what we can just dump cash, dump cash, dump cash, and when it doesn't produce results, it's time to start thinking outside the box. And one of the issues that you had just mentioned was that $46.2 million that went just to the New Haven public schools alone. There was every city got some, but the $46.2 million that went to New Haven schools, a lot of it went to like trying to update HVAC systems in empty schools, which, I mean, they're brand new schools and they were empty. There's not a lot you're going to be doing about COVID airflow, laminar flow, or I don't know what they were doing exactly. So that was money spent ineffectively. What that should have been spent on was tutoring the children, when instead their scores dropped dramatically over COVID. And that's the kind of mishandling of funds that we see throughout the system. I would also stress the fact that of the social issues that and mental health issues that cause children to lack the reading readiness before they get to the public schools. And one of those is, like I was saying, the age 0 to 3 months is a very important time for neurodevelopment. And we have to get the local parents or local people involved in, like the reading doulas that I was talking about, partnering with a lot of the mental health, modeling parenting, modeling reading to children, all of those things. It really has to be a comprehensive societal-based approach because there's a lot of trauma and a lot of unstable housing, a lot of mental health problems, a lot of people that don't know how to parent, and that also contributes to it. But the problem is not the funds themselves. It's the way they are spent incorrectly that's the problem.
Justin, did you want to respond to specifically to the educational part?
Yeah, I would chime in and agree with Amy that preschool and daycare are essential tools for parents, and they need to have those available. And, you know, the Green Party platform, similar to Bernie Sanders, would make those free. And I do believe we can afford to do such things if we redirect our priorities towards that kind of social spending and away from the money we waste on the Pentagon. As the prime example of misspent funds, I favor universal free education from birth through college.
Wow, I like that. How do you feel about that, Dr. Amy?
Well, I, for one, I actually believe in school choice. And I do think that charter schools have shown dramatic results. And I've spoken to people who run charter schools, which are basically, they're not for-profit, they're nonprofit entities, but they just run a different way because they're not controlled by the state curriculum development, which has had a lot of ideology in it and not enough science in it. I mean, we know how children read, and that hasn't always been the way reading has been taught. So why is it that a New Haven charter school third graders can get like the third highest math score in the entire state? And we're talking, you know, we're comparing with like excellent, you know, private schools, third highest in the state, even though they had a 98% poverty rate and almost everyone was non-white in that school. They're doing something that's different. And what is the different thing that they're doing? It doesn't really have to do with the money. It has to do with something else, like how they're approaching the education. So no, I don't think we should have like necessarily free college, but I think we should have we shouldn't be focusing on giving a lot of student loans because that has caused huge inflation at the school level as far as what they're spending on it. But if college is free, I think people aren't putting into it the kind of seriousness that needs to happen. But it's definitely overpriced. We need to do, there's a lot of work we need to do on higher education as well.
Justin, give you a quick rebuttal on that. Do you think free college, the idea of not having skin in the game, takes away from the experience?
I don't really worry about that. I think that I'm more concerned about people not having access to education who are serious and want to get in but simply don't have the funds to afford it. That's the problem that I see is, you know, prevailing there.
In studio guests, Dr. Amy Chai, the Independent Party candidate, and Justin Paglino, the Green Party's candidate for the 3rd District Congressional race. We did invite Rosa DeLauro. She, I guess, has passed. Didn't get an actual response. And Leslie DeNardis, the Republican, will be here tomorrow at 1:30. And again, I'm just going to hit all these same questions right to her, and she'll have her chance to make her case. All right, Justin, let's talk about the economy. Let's talk about inflation. President Joe Biden took some flack for calling the economy strong as hell while eating an ice cream cone, with his sleeves clearly rolled up 3/4. That's how you're supposed to do it. He's gotten a lot of flack for that. Obviously, the economy is not strong as hell. Inflation is back on the rise. And we also know Saudi Arabia and OPEC is cutting oil production. It's going to cause gas prices to go back up. Most people, and in all of these polls, most people point to this as being the number one issue that they're facing. If we were to send you to Washington, D.C., what do you think is the best way to fight inflation and get this economy back on its feet?
Yeah, we have had worsening income inequality in this country for several decades now. That's grown to obscene proportions. We have the bottom half of Americans owning 2% of the wealth, and these people are living, as Bernie says, you know, paycheck to paycheck, and they are struggling to make ends meet. There are 70,000 approximately people dying each year because they don't have health insurance. And my kind of flagship issue, besides ranked choice voting, is Medicare for all. I do believe we need single payer free healthcare for everyone. And according to the vast majority of the studies that have been done on this, it would save money. It would be less expensive than the current system, which is about $3 trillion, and it would save maybe 10%, so 10 to 15. So it'd be, we'd save $300 to $450 billion a year. So why not adopt a system of universal health care like they have in every other industrialized country, where we are not having, you know, I think it's 500,000 bankruptcies a year, mostly due to medical debt, and everyone gets covered and can be healthier and more productive and not have the skyrocketing cost of health care be a burden on people. There are other things I advocate to address the economic, the dire straits that people in the lower half of the economic strata find themselves in. But I think that's number one, because that's a major expense for a lot of people.
Dr. Amy, your thoughts on making this economy healthier and working to shrink inflation?
Okay, well, I would probably stop printing money first. And I mean, they've been using a model where they're like, oh, it's low. There's low unemployment, so there's really not going to be inflation. But that's actually not true, because when you have a shortage of goods and you keep printing money, then you get into like a death spiral of inflation, and then people can't afford to buy goods, and then you have to give them extra aid by printing more dollars to help them buy the goods that they can't afford. And before you know it, you're in crazy town. So the first thing I would do is I would stop printing money. I would also stop sending billions of dollars worth of weaponry to the Ukraine and to Yemen. There is one thing. I love helping other people. I think it's great when we help other people. I don't think it's great when we fight proxy wars and give, like, become a weapons dealers and spend all our money in that way. I think that's not ethical, and it's not financially viable. I think that what we should do is we should actually alter some of the way that our tax system works. And there's a couple things I would like to change about taxes. Now, when I was growing up, my dad made about $2,000 a year, and he was self-employed. And so he had to pay 15% off the top because of the self-employment tax. If you're self-employed, you have to pay double the FICA tax for Social Security. I would completely eliminate the self-employment portion of FICA, which I call the self-employment tax, because if somebody's going to hustle enough to employ themselves, they're not rich people. And this 15% hack off their income is devastating to families. So I would cut that. You know, if you're like a self-employed person, you should not have to pay 15% off the top and then have income taxes on top of that. I would also shift the focus of what we are taxing from earned income onto wealth transfer. What that means is that typically what you tax, you're going to get less of. And that's why we have the sin tax and the luxury tax. Like, you're not going to buy cigarettes eventually if the cigarette costs like $1,000 a pack, right? And that's actually, I think they're like $12 or $15 now. But when you're taxing work, you're actually disincentivizing it. And I mean, I've seen that play out in my own life. So I think there should be a flat tax for earned income, flat. And I think that the tax should shift onto wealth transfers, such as you know, the tax per trade type of things, different ways that we could recoup a lot of the money that is just sort of shuffled around, making money off of money, which isn't really adding value to the economy, but it's actually taking money away from the economy. And one of my favorite books on this topic, of course, it's called Better Capitalism. And it's about how we apply capitalism better with a more moral framework in society to create healthier local economies, and to really focus a lot more on the local economies rather than giant mega international business and wealth transfer in the financial industry. So that's what I would do to improve our economy.
All right. As far as inflation, for both of you, I'm thinking something a little more immediate because, again, it's not dropping anytime soon. They're saying we should see a recession 2023 that should be ending into early 2024. Again, we're talking to Green Party's candidate Justin Paglino and the independent candidate Dr. Amy Chai. Justin, how would you address inflation short term just to make things a little bit easier? I'm very concerned about senior citizens and the poor surviving a winter where they may have to choose between home heating oil and food.
Yeah. You know, in terms of inflation, I want to echo something that Amy said about printing money. A lot of, you know, what the Fed has been doing is giving money to financial institutions. And and they call it quantitative easing. And it's basically, I've spoken to someone who is involved in or reports on this kind of this sector for a living. They said basically they just click a button and give large amounts of money to financial institutions. It's just a giveaway. And of course, that puts more money into circulation, which devalues the dollar. And it leads to inflation because it devalues the dollar and then prices go higher. I think we need to look at, the prices and whether we can mandate in some way some kind of price controls. The problem is, it's basically price gouging. If a corporation is making enormous amounts of money going into profit, there needs to be some check on them to make sure that they are not taking advantage of the situation and just raising prices just because they can. I also wanted to address tax structure a little bit, mm-hmm. if I could, that Amy was talking about. I like Amy's plan to tax passive income at the same rate as earned income, because like she says, you know, it, when you tax something, you can get less of it. And it's just simply not fair that passive income, the income you get from stocks and bonds, is taxed at a different rate, at a lower rate than income. That should have been rectified a long time ago. We have people amassing large amounts of money. My view of economics in general is that, left unattended, we all know this, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. That is just the nature of economics. If there is no intelligent oversight of the economic system, because advantage begets advantage, you have wealth, it's easier to make more wealth. You're poor, it's harder to get ahead. And I view it as a important function of government to address that problem, because otherwise, as we're seeing, it gets out of control. And so that's why I favor progressive income taxes. Generally shy away from the idea of a flat tax, even though it's not a regressive tax. But I stand fully morally behind the idea of a progressive tax.
Joined in studio by Green Party's candidate for U.S. 3rd Congressional District, Justin Paglino, and the independent candidate, Dr. Amy Chai. Thank you guys both for being here. Much appreciated.
Thanks. Thank you.
We're having a great time.
Yeah. You know what? And again, I like to, you guys seem to get along really well. And I think that's so important. You know, it's good for the people to see candidates together talking about issues that are important to them.
Yeah. And right? we don't agree on everything.
No, you
and
definitely
that's okay.
Don't.
And that's okay.
Yeah. Well, that's democracy.
Right.
Well, speaking of democracy, let's talk about voting. Let's talk about voter suppression. Let's talk about ballot access. And my mom's favorite, it's one Dr. Amy brought up last time she was here, and that's ranked choice voting. Justin, we'll start with you.
Ranked choice voting is such an important reform that we need. We already have it in Alaska and Maine and many municipalities across the country. In Australia, they've had it for 100 years, and they love it. And basically, it's my solution to the two-party system, because it eliminates the problem of vote splitting, the problem of people strategically voting, and they worry about throwing away their vote. They worry about tipping the election to the lesser evil. Ranked choice voting solves that problem. And it's a very simple and, you know, tested and proven method of voting. Like I said, 100 years in Australia, they've been using this. And what it does is it allows people to, instead of just voting for one candidate, you rank the candidates in order of preference. You check, you know, number one, number two, number three, and as many as you want. And then if your first place choice comes in last after the first round of counting, they're eliminated, but your vote is not discarded. Your vote goes now to your second choice. So, you know, in a race like this, if people liked me and my support for Medicare for All, which Rosa doesn't support, they could vote for Medicare for All, vote for me as their first choice. But if they have a preference between the other candidates, they can rank their second most favorite candidate second, knowing and feeling safe that they don't that if I come in last, or you know, in the second round, if I come in second to last, you know, their vote will go to their next choice candidate. And I could talk about how this improves our system in so many ways. Mm-hmm. We have this two-party system of people polarizing, people, you know, in a two-party system, you only have to convince voters that your opponent is the devil incarnate.
Yep.
In order to win. Right. And that's why we have so much mudslinging, because mm-hmm. that's the strategy that candidates are going to use in this system. In a ranked choice voting system, it's much more about trying to reach the broadest possible audience and trying to appeal to the greatest number of voters. You don't want to be too insulting to a voter's first choice candidate if you're hoping to get their second choice vote. It really makes a difference. in terms of the tone of politics. It allows more voices to come into the race, more diversity of opinions to be heard. And I think it's more representative. When people only have two choices, what if you don't feel you like one of those two choices? What are you supposed to do? And so many of us face this conundrum when we go to vote.
Every time.
Yeah. And no one likes it. And, you know, the polling, people wanting a third party is, is it in the 60s, I think, somewhere. I mean, people really are tired of the two-party system. Mm-hmm. But not everybody knows that ranked choice voting is a simple solution. It's working in Maine. It's working in Alaska. It's worked in Australia for 100 years. And it will just make everything better. If there's one thing I'd love to see in my lifetime, it's to see ranked choice voting come to America and the two-party system, create a multi-party democracy. I think this two-party system is so toxic. John Adams said he feared the division of the republic into two great parties would be the greatest political evil under our Constitution. And that's exactly what we have right now. And I think it's turning a lot of people away from believing in our democracy, turning a lot of people away from voting and participating at all. And I think that's even why some people are turning, losing faith in democracy and turning to the idea of a strong man, an outsider, kind of an authoritarian kind of person. I won't name any names who might be able to come in and kind of just bust the system by brute force with his power, because I think they turn to that when they feel like they're not being represented by any of the traditional electoral means and their voice isn't getting out there. So it's a better system. It's more representative. And I think we need it urgently.
Solid points. Yeah, I hadn't even actually ever thought about the idea, because part of what Dr. Amy and I, you and I have talked about, the idea of there being a third party kind of lessens the extremisms that the right or left can go if there's somebody who's in the middle, who's a third choice. But as you said, I don't want to wreck your first choice if I want to be your second guy.
Yeah.
Because, and you know, Dr. Amy knows, I am so done with the rhetoric. I think that when you're looking at the increase of violence in this country, I think politicians' dangerous rhetoric, as you said, like dehumanizing and making the other guy the devil incarnate, is part of the reason why we're seeing the spike in violence that we're seeing in this country.
I agree. We've seen explicitly political violence lately, and it can be directly traced back to that kind of demonizing, not just demonizing of a policy, not just demonizing of a candidate, but actually demonizing the voters themselves, who really only have two choices. And there may be a very good reason for whatever choice they're voting for, but now they're actually demonizing voters. And that's going incredibly too far. It's breaking up relationships. It's breaking up families. It's causing a lot of the problems that we're having with mental health and depression. People just don't feel like they're in a community anymore. They don't feel like they can speak their mind anymore. And the two-party system is very much a dinosaur of the last century. It is something that actually thrives off of division. It's something, it doesn't solve problems. It subsidizes problems because it uses problems as a wedge against the other party. So it's actually not motivated to solve problems because those problems are needed. Because once the problems goes away, it's really hard to paint your opponent as the devil incarnate.
Yeah.
So I completely agree.
Did you see this new poll from Siena? 1 in 5 people say politics has hurt a friendship or a family relationship. In this poll, 14% of people said who you vote for determines to them whether you're a good or a bad person.
Wow.
And I think, again, that's people getting tied into the rhetoric, really doubling down on the politics. It's dangerous.
It's dangerous.
And leads to, again, the violence and the divisiveness
right,
that we're seeing.
Right. And that's why I describe myself so much as a pragmatist rather than an ideologue. Because I think when we talk about ideology on one side or the other, political party-wise, then there comes to be almost a religious or moralistic overtone to being part of this tribe or this belief system that is incredibly dangerous and toxic, and it makes the other person not just wrong, but also immoral. And that's why we need to look at issues with pragmatism and solve them. And that's why ranked choice voting it's really going to be a huge step in the right direction.
Yeah. You know, I'll say in a two-party system, it becomes more like a sport, more like a war with two sides, and everyone feels compelled to pick a side. And it starts to matter less what the actual policies are that your side has chosen. And the standard is lowered. Your bar of what you will support is lowered. You'll take anything that this party will get you if that's your side and you prefer them even slightly to the other side. So it's completely toxic and inadequate. And, you know, imagine families getting together and saying, oh, who's your first choice? Who's your second choice? I think, you know, that would – it just opens the possibilities for much more rational discourse.
Sure, right? I mean, I think if you could sit there with your family and decide in order which candidates you like, and everybody could sort of state their case for their guy, you know, it might help you in your rankings or whatever. I think that would be a much more harmonious situation. And again, I'm thinking about the third week of November, which will be about 2 weeks after the election, and kind of where people are going to be at sitting around a Thanksgiving table.
Yeah.
Right? It's going to literally play itself out in just a couple of weeks. Anyway, we are with Dr. Amy Chai, the independent candidate, and Justin Paglino, the Green Party's candidate for the U.S. 3rd Congressional District. Tomorrow at 1:30, Leslie DeNardis, the Republican candidate, will be here. We did reach out to Rosa DeLauro. She's not here. That's all I could tell you.
I was thinking about how can I make cricket sounds, but I don't know.
I wish Rosa was here. I don't know why Rosa's not looking to do interviews or get into any kind of debates. I don't know if she just believes that's just her seat and she's entitled to it. I'd like to see her work for it.
Yeah. Can I just mention that 2 years ago there was a debate on Channel 8 and I got to participate with Rosa and the Republican. And, you know, this year, no debate. They're being run by the League of Women Voters, who I've always loved as an organization, but I'm disappointed in them because they set these standards that you have to raise $15,000 within your district to be considered a viable candidate. It's just another way of putting money first in politics and creating a financial hurdle that if you want to get hit in politics, you got to prove that you can generate cash.
Right. It's like the Jim Crow laws of the South, really. And it is voter suppression because people who are less wealthy are unable to raise the amount of money that they need to get. And for me, I don't take PAC money. I don't believe in campaign donations from special interest groups. I don't believe in dark money. I don't believe in these things that are causing the corruption. And so it's like, I'm not interested in that. But then you're interested in $50 from, you know, a neighbor, and that doesn't add up very fast.
No, it doesn't
add up to $15,000 very fast at all.
No.
And, you know, that debates should be publicly held. I don't see why we have private organizations deciding who's
yes.
going to
yeah.
who's going to be at the debate, who's going to get invited. It should be, it's a public good. It's part of democracy, and it should just be run by the government publicly, and all candidates who are on the ballot, they've proven themselves that they're worthy of being heard by the voters because they've had to go out and get a lot of signatures, and everyone should be invited. And if, you know, if only one person comes, give them the airtime. You know, they're there. They want to talk because, you know, our debate got canceled. Our debate got canceled because they considered Amy and I, quote unquote, non-viable, which hurt my feelings. And then I think Rosa declined, and they were left with one candidate, the Republican, and so they consider that inadequate. According to their rules, if only one person's going to show up, they're going to cancel the debate. you know, it just gives people too much of an easy way of getting out of this. I mean, the voters deserve to hear a debate.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you both accepting the invitation. Again, Leslie DeNardis will be here tomorrow at 1:30. We'll put her feet to the fire, ask her all these same topics, see where she's at. And I think people know where Rosa stands. I think we've seen the numbers in New Haven, so we know what the results have looked like. And so you'll have to judge for yourself. Joined in studio by Dr. Amy Chai, the independent candidate for the 3rd Congressional District, and Justin Paglino, the Green Party's candidate, the crickets symbolizing Rosa DeLauro not showing up. And again, as I mentioned, Leslie DeNardis, the Republican candidate, will be here tomorrow at 1:30. Because I know it's the biggest issue for the Democrats, and despite neither of you being Democrats, I figure we should at least talk about this for a hot second. Where do you guys stand on women's reproductive rights?
I believe medical decisions are private decisions. Amy and I both went to medical school, and I think my view is that legislatures do not have the medical expertise to be practicing medicine. Pregnancy is a complicated issue. There are complications. It can be a life-threatening conditions. I've seen a woman whose heart stopped in the middle of a C-section while I was in medical school. I mean, there are complications that can develop very late in pregnancy. Medical decisions, I feel, are private decisions. They are best made by the patient and the doctor together, with the patient bringing their concerns and priorities to the table and the doctor bringing their medical expertise to the table, and put them in a room together and leave them alone and let them make the best medical decision for the patient. And I feel that that's the way we should handle all medical issues.
I've always been curious, and I mean, you're a doctor. Are you a doctor?
I'm an MD. I'm not practicing. I went into medical research for a number of years.
Okay. So I don't have to call you Dr. Justin, should I?
You don't have to. You can.
I will, Dr. Justin. Well, I've always been curious about this. The idea that, like, we don't often report on medical procedures as a nation. Like, how many knee replacements? There's not, like, a national database on that, or open heart surgery. Why are abortions, how many there are, why is that so carefully tracked by the government?
I don't know that. You mean policy?
Yeah,
issue.
Like they literally release, here's how many abortions happened in 2020. Why are we even talking about people's medical situations?
Well, I guess the real reason is medical ethics. And the question is, like, when is it acceptable to take a human life? And, you know, when is it not acceptable to take a human life? And I will say that I have performed abortion, but I would not perform abortion unless it was medically necessary. And I think one of the things that we have failed miserably to do is to differentiate between therapeutic abortion, which is abortion for life, health, and, you know, extenuating circumstances for the woman, versus, the abortion, which is just of convenience. So federally, if you sent me to Washington, D.C., I would basically say we should codify all therapeutic abortions federally, because that is a medical decision. If someone is, and I would include rape in that too, because that is something that can cause severe psychological distress, and I would add that into therapeutic. I would also add into therapeutic certain birth defects that aren't compatible with life. So that would be what I would call therapeutic abortion. The other type of abortion is elective abortion, which is just abortion because, you know, you decided, you know, your boyfriend left or whatever. And that happens too. Like I said, we don't know how to love each other anymore in this world. And that's a shame. You know, in the ideal world, people wouldn't be horrible people. You know, they would love each other. But there are, you know, that can be relegated to the states, and then that would accurately reflect the beliefs of the local community. So what I see here in Connecticut is a lot of abortion extremism, where they're just screaming like, you can't have a nuanced discussion about this. And like once when I was in medical school, one of my neurology professors was, you know, taking late term fetuses that had, you know, been aborted or whatever. And he was taking like the surgical shears and, you know, disarticulating the leg much as you would like from a chicken or something, and taking the nerves out of the legs and doing the research on those nerves. And then, you know, one day he was starting to cut through the fetus's leg and it tried to escape because it's still alive. And he was like cutting through the leg and, you know, dropped the fetus. And, you know, it's just disturbing some of the things that do go on. And, you know, we have to realize, yes, it's ending a human life. It's ending a human life. But sometimes it's okay to end a human life. Sometimes you should really be thinking twice about it. And most of the women who do get abortions have already had abortions in the past, and they're using it for birth control. And that's just the fact. I've told hundreds of women that they're pregnant, and I always ask them, what are you using for birth control? And most of them say nothing. And then I say, well, were you trying to get pregnant? And they said no. And so I'm like, do you know how babies come? So we have safe and effective birth control. Why don't we use it? Why don't we use it? I mean, we have baskets of condoms to take.
Do we need better sexual education?
No, everyone knows. Everyone knows.
Do they?
They do. Yeah, they do. And I try to get them. I've tried so hard to get people to take a shot, to use a condom, to do it. And people just, they don't want to.
Huh. Interesting.
I like the, you know, it's a tremendously difficult moral issue. And, you know, I don't mean to, you know, I understand the moral, you know, concerns involved with ending a human life or a potential person's life, depending on how people look at it. But I like the distinction of a therapeutic abortion versus an elective abortion as maybe a way we could make some progress on this issue as a country, because obviously it's so divisive, and we need to look for areas where people could come
Where
people can agree. And I think there widespread agreement could be found for people saying that therapeutic abortions, just under the categories that you mentioned, should be safe and legal. And then, you know, the elective abortion issue will remain controversial.
State by state, yeah.
Well, it'll remain controversial.
It will, yeah.
And I'm not sure where things will end up, you know, but I understand the moral arguments on both sides. And, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to call them abortions of convenience. I mean, having an unwanted pregnancy is a lot more than inconvenient. It's life-altering.
In studio guests, Dr. Amy Chai, the independent candidate, and Dr. Justin Piglino, the Green Party candidate for the U.S. 3rd Congressional District. We were going to do this for an hour. I neglected one major, major topic, so we're just going to spill over into this 1 o'clock hour. I've got to talk about the environment. I believe in climate change. I gave a lesson here last week on the effects of climate change and how important that is, because I feel like a lot of people, unfortunately, it tends to be people more to the right than the left, that think it is not real and don't understand the severity of it, the rising sea levels, the melting ice caps. These are all very real things. In 1987, we ended the use of the fluorocarbons or whatever those things were, and it had an enormous impact on the ozone hole.
It did.
And, you know, it's funny, when it happened, there were a lot of people that were opposed to it, and not many people have reported on what happened in the aftermath of it. And miraculously, the hole started to close.
Yeah.
So we do control that very much. You're a green energy person. You're from the Green Party. I think you guys will have some good things to say here. What are your thoughts on the economy? What would you like on the economy, on the environment, and what sort of policies would you be looking to impose?
Yeah, I'm very concerned about the climate. I'm concerned about the environment in general and the amount of pollution that we're putting into the environment and what effect that might be having on our cancer rates. But the climate issue in particular, I think, is more impactful than a lot of people appreciate. We've known about this issue for a long time. There's really no question in the scientific community that this is posing a significant threat to our way of life. I mean, human society has existed in about this temperature since the dawn of civilization, since we came out of the last ice age. And, you know, we have a lot of infrastructure that's built to exist in the current climate. We have a lot of infrastructure that is close to sea level. We have a lot of our major cities are very close to sea level. And we are facing a potential of, you know, 20, 40 feet of sea level rise with the melting of the Greenland ice sheet. And, you know, we've been observing the melting of the ice sheets and the glaciers. I mean, but if it affects so many things. It affects our food supply, our ability to grow food. It affects, of course, storms and the severity of storms. It causes droughts. It causes it worsens droughts. It worsens storms that are tremendously expensive to address. So when people bring up that they're worried, they don't want to spend money on climate change. We don't have the money to spend on addressing this problem. Look at the costs we're spending on disaster relief, and it's been going up. The trend is up because the disasters are getting worse. Mm-hmm. Look at the subways flooding after Hurricane Sandy. The cyclones are moving closer to the poles. They're getting, animal species are moving closer to the poles. All kinds of consequences. And so I very much feel that this is, a stitch in time saves nine. We spend a dollar now or we spend $100 later. You know, we have to put our money into this. And again, like I mentioned earlier, this is a case of where do we put our priorities? We have only a certain amount of money to spend as a nation, as a government. What do we want to be spending it on? Right now, we're spending half our discretionary budget on warfare, the military. And I think there's a lot of corruption that feeds that. I think there are contractors, military contractors in every state that are making great amount of money off of the Pentagon budget, and then a lot of that money goes back into funding the campaigns of politicians who go in and vote for more Pentagon spending. I don't think there's a real need for military or, you know, security need for the Pentagon spending at the level it is right now, close to $800 billion a year, you know, not counting our occasional wars. So, yes, we have a lot of infrastructure to redirect towards clean energy infrastructure. My house, you know, we use heating oil, and I looked into geothermal, and they told me, well, you'd have to add ducting to the entire first level. And that's expensive. This is not an easy transition for people to make, especially mm-hmm. people, you know, I mean, people are already struggling. This can't just be public service announcements and educating people on how to go green. We need people need leadership. People need help. We need to assist people who want to make their lives more eco-friendly, more and lower their carbon footprint. We need to assist them. And that's the government's job.
I like that. Dr. Amy, I know you got some thoughts on the matter.
I do. Yeah. First, I wanted to say I know that, like, the Democrats have got the Green New Deal proposed. And I find, unfortunately, that the response from the Republicans has been, oh, the Green New Deal is bad. But they haven't produced any alternative ideas. And so I've been thinking about a lot and working on alternative ideas. And I do agree that carbon capture is important, and it's a matter, again, of pragmatism and what's going to work. And the problem that I see with the Democrats' policy, the Green New Deal, is number one, that it leaves the door open to the kind of unfortunate, like, crony spend that we've been seeing this whole time, except on a massive, 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 massive scale.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I see is a lot of the things that they're advocating for are really not ready for prime time. I feel like, you know, and the whole idea of the New Deal, that's so 1900s, isn't it? That's why I named my policy plan the Green Future Initiative, because it's for a green future. And I'll just give you an example of the kind of spending that the government has done. Like, I mean, we all know about Solyndra, the $500 million that was flushed. They were trying to build high-speed rail infrastructure in California. They had a $20 billion budget. They only built 20 miles. That's $1 billion per mile.
That's not good.
And now they're like looking for another $157 billion and thinking, oh, what should we do about this high-speed rail that is here? We have 20 miles of track. And it's like, this is a kind of spending disaster that happens when you have people in Congress that have no idea about what science even is or how to even evaluate if a science is a good idea. But hey, my brother-in-law has this company. Let's give him this contract and let's pour billions of dollars down the toilet. And that's the kind of thing that happens. So what happens is, for Green New Deal, spend lots of money, doesn't save the environment. Okay. So I have a little bit more of a capitalistic bent here. One of them is, you know, everyone pays taxes, right? And the government actually funds a lot of the tech research, a lot of the science research. But not only can we not even read it because we have to pay for the journals, but you know, when an entrepreneur gets the goes to the other end and says, hey, now we have this great developed idea, I'm going to run with it and make millions and millions of dollars, the taxpayer never really gets anything out of that. And so one of the things I wanted to do is open up a huge information infrastructure, which is, you know, mostly online. You can look and see what grants are up for funding. You can do discussion boards about, hey, this grant looks cool. You can actually take tax budget dollars and actually invest it into green research that you want to see federally funded. And then what happens if that technology takes off? Well, you get some stock in it and you get some actual return for yourself.
Hmm.
And so what that does is that makes people super interested in this green tech. People are going to invest in the best one and it's going to take off. And that's a good way to invest in green tech where regular people like you and me can take tax dollars and benefit from it.
Yeah, a little Shark Tank action.
A little Shark Tank, exactly. And then the other specific concern that I have is regional differences in environmental needs. And that's why I also wanted to have something that I call sustainability zones. And these sustainability zones are areas that could become a closed loop in the event of a disaster. So what we do is we build local infrastructure, small businesses, small local farms, everything small and local. It really builds and strengthens the local economy. It reduces the carbon footprint of all this, you know, trucking and shipping and big farming and this and that. And it makes it a lot more local. And different regions have different concerns. Like here in New England, we have different concerns than they have in California. So mm-hmm. Why should we have the same ideas in our region than in their region? That doesn't make sense. So we each region is local and we get to make our own decisions on what we do. And then we have a closed loopability in the sustainability zone. Of course, you know, we might have to have toilet paper manufacture just in case there's another COVID. but it would be very sustainable in that region, local sustainability. And that's going to be more local food production and hopefully less food waste as well, because we all know that food waste itself is a big carbon generator. One of the other areas that I am having a little bit of trouble with is so much advancement of certain types of technology that's not quite ready for prime time, especially a lot of the energy production that's not energy dense. In fact, that requires a lot of non-recyclable materials, and that's, you know, that can be very damaging to the environment. And you can just talk about something like the lithium batteries with the lithium mines, the cobalt mines, the strip mining, the international issues that causes, the transportation that causes, and then the fact that you're often burning coal to support them, which puts radiation into the air and puts a lot of greenhouse gases into the air, all for a product that may not work as well as you think it works. And then, but there's other ideas that need to come to the forefront, things like carbon capture technologies, where you can actually create a liquid fuel that's actually sustainable by like carbon capture from the atmosphere. And you can actually catalyze a reaction where you get hydrogen and put it in there, and you can actually generate liquid fuels such as like ethanol or propane or, you know, butane, these organic carbon hydrocarbon molecules in liquid form by using carbon capture. And that actually makes liquid fuel sustainable. Mm-hmm. Now, this technology is really in its infancy, too, but that's something we should like be pouring research money into. We should be also doing things that are fun. Like, we should be doing things together as communities. Like, instead of saying, oh, stop driving to work while I fly my private jet to Davos, what we could actually be doing is people getting together with all the best information and working together as a community with community-based grants to do things that are going to work in their environment. Like, how are we going to, like, eliminate food waste here, for example? How are we going to improve like our transportation here, with maybe a little like block grant style type of more locally based and more entrepreneurial and less big government top down green crony spending stuff. So and of course that also comes along with, I know they just passed that STEM and CHIPS and STEM law, which I think is a good bill. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, people like the children in our schools, they can't access that because they're only doing math. 12% of them are on grade level in math. And we really need to like hit the math and the STEM, because having a workforce that is smart, understands science, and is able to do science and participate in the tech economy is going to be crucial for the whole thing to actually work.
Science is real. And I'm so glad there's doctors running in this election cycle. I've noticed a lot more doctors and people of science in this election around the country and here in Connecticut. And I think that's important. Like you said, sometimes people that don't know what they're talking about are trying to make policy, and that's really bad.
That happens every day.
Oh, I know. Dr. Justin Pollino, I want you to stick around after this just for a few minutes, just so we can kind of get to know you. You're the Green Party candidate. What's your website?
JustinForAll.org.
And Dr. Amy Chai, the independent congressional candidate in the 3rd District, your website?
It's DocChai2022.com.
I want to thank you both for showing up for our little on-air radio debate. Much appreciated. Again, Leslie DeNardis, the Republican candidate, is going to get all the same topics tomorrow at 1:30. We appreciate that from her. And, yeah, I don't know about Rosa, but not here.
She's not here.
Thank you to both of you. That was fantastic stuff. Much appreciated. The Green Party candidate for the U.S. Congressional 3rd District, Justin Pollino, was just on here debating with Dr. Amy Chai. And I asked him to hang out for just a few more minutes, just so we can kind of get to know this guy real quick before we send him on his way. You also had a couple thoughts rebuttal-wise on the environment. Why don't you go ahead and...
Yeah, I just wanted to address that issue of like the cylinder type thing and the crony capitalism spending that is a danger in legislation that comes out of D.C. And You know, if I had to pick something that's a common thread of a lot of the bad legislation that comes out of D.C., it's legislation being crafted to the liking of the party's largest donors, their corporate supporters, and Wall Street's interests. You know, so in you know, I think it's the reason we don't have Medicare. But take Obamacare. You know, in Obamacare, what did they do? They said, okay, we're not going to provide a public option. We're just going to take taxpayer money and use it to help people buy private insurance from private companies. That helps companies. That just helps, helps them have more customers and make a bigger profit. And all that money's coming from the taxpayer. That's kind of the, you know, the crony spending that I think, you know, Amy and I agree is a problem. I mean, you see it in other sectors too. But when it comes to energy, it's the same thing. We don't want, you know, I think we need to take back public ownership of things that are public goods, like healthcare and also like energy. Let's have, you know, we the people take over the government, which is supposed to belong to us, and then put in place public spending that is for the public good. So that would include, you know, having public utilities so that we the people can make decisions. I mean, the underlying problem here is that these decisions aren't really being made by what would be a government really representative of people and people's interests. We have a government that is being funded by wealthy interests, and they're the ones who end up winning out at the end of the day when legislation is written. So you have to kind of envision a better system of government, you know, one with public campaign finance to be able to envision the what I think are the necessary solutions to a lot of our problems. If you have, if you get the money out of politics, you can craft legislation that really is in people's interest. And like with energy, you know, the private companies, Eversource and so on, are going to do whatever's in their best financial interest, mm-hmm. and they're gonna spend some of their money lobbying to get the laws to support them, right? But if we have public utilities, then we the people can come and say, okay, we want to bring more renewable resources into the energy mix, and that's what we're going to do, and we have the power to do it because this is a public utility. And on a national level, you know, we can also, I think money would be well spent creating a civilian job corps, a green energy infrastructure workforce. I believe in a federal jobs guarantee so that if making the federal government the employer of last resort for anyone who's looking for a job and is unable to find one in the private market, that the federal government, you know, much like FDR did with his, his public works program, because we have, like I said, there's a lot of infrastructure work to be done to try and convert to a clean energy economy. This mm-hmm. is not straightforward. This is something that takes a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of effort. And if we leave corporations in charge of this, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. We're talking to Justin Pollino, the Green Party candidate for the U.S. 3rd congressional race. He was here with Dr. Amy Chai. Doing a debate here on the radio. We appreciate that. And Justin, I do appreciate you just kind of popping in here, showing up. You were like, I'll go win coal. I don't need to know anything. That's the kind of refreshing candidacy I'm looking for. And before you go, I just wanted to give you a chance to just talk a little bit about yourself. Who are you? I only found out you were a doctor about halfway through the debate. So if you tell us a little bit about you, where you're from, and then ultimately what got you into this race.
Sure. Well, I was born in 1973 in Shelton. My father worked. He was an aeronautical engineer. He worked on designing helicopter blades for Sikorsky. Then he worked for GE. We moved to Erie, Pennsylvania. We moved to Cincinnati, Ohio. I came back east for college, went to Brown and then Brown Medical School, and then got engaged, did a 2-year residency in lab medicine at Yale. That's what brought me back to Connecticut. I was very happy to feel like I was coming back home to a state that I really love. And, you know, after 2 years of residency, I really had this drive to want to do more research. I was really interested in basic medical research. So I entered a program at Yale called Investigative Medicine Program that you do 5 years, you know, well, it varies, but I took me 5 years, and you get You do research and you write a thesis and you defend it and you take coursework and you get a PhD. And for 10 years after that, I did more basic research in a different lab, also at Yale. My research involved virological treatment of cancer. So I would take viruses, infect tumor cells in a culture dish or in animal models, and try to kill the tumors or try to generate an immune response against the tumors. And it was tremendously challenging and stimulating, but it was also very difficult. And I was able to get a 5-year award to support my research from the National Cancer Institute, what they call a career award. But my research didn't produce the data I needed. It was, you know, my own ideas, my own grant that I wrote to get that award. But sometimes research doesn't work out. And I didn't get the data I needed to be able to publish anything, right, really. And so that was a kind of a case of publish or perish, and I kind of perished. But I was also approaching, I'm midlife, I'm almost 50, and I've always been passionate about politics and justice in general, and good governance and fairness, and been concerned about poverty, pollution, and people struggling and wanting to see a better country, and the country that I grew up in, that I love. And I've been an activist my whole life. I've gone to peace marches and climate marches and this and that. And when I retired, I knew that partly I wanted to spend more time on music because I'm also a musician, but I knew I wanted to spend a lot of time as being an activist. And I quickly kind of came to the conclusion that running for office was one of the most effective things that anyone can do as an activist. I view the Green Party as the political arm of the peace movement, the environmental movement, the social justice movement, the economic justice movement. I really feel like, these are our values, and we want to have them clearly represented on the ballot so that people can vote for them. Because if you can't vote for something, you're never going to get it. The Democratic Party, I was a member for most of my life until 2 years ago. And I came to understand that a better system was possible when I learned about ranked choice voting. I said, hey, Why keep banging your head up against the wall trying to reform this party that's deeply corrupted by money? The people are good. The people mean well. Mm-hmm. But we're in this horrible system that only gives you two choices. And between the Republicans and the Democrats, I prefer the Democrats. But that two-party system has made it possible for the Democrats to lower the quality of policies that they offer because people have nowhere else to turn. So, they'll take what they can get, and the Democratic Party can position themselves in a way that they're going to rake in a lot of money from donors like insurance companies. But they also have they can get the support of the base of the party because they have nowhere else to turn. And they kind of get the both of best worlds. But, people, like I said, are turning away from this. They're tired of this. They're tired of only having two choices. And if we want a better system, we have to create it. Right. And I realized, I went to the Green Party and said, who's running for Congress? And they said, well, we don't have anybody. And I said, well,
you do now.
Somebody's got to do it. I'll do it. Not that I ever had the ambition to do it. It's just that my ideals and my desire to contribute something, led me to this position.
Justin, I really appreciate you coming by. I'd love to have you back again sometime soon. We can get more into your campaign. The Green Party's candidate for the U.S. 3rd Congressional District, Dr. Justin Pollino. One more time, give him the website.
Yeah, the website is justinforall.org. And I'd just like to mention quickly that we have a candidate for Attorney General, Ken Krajewski, and would really appreciate people's support for Ken because the Green Party is a minor party in Connecticut. And if we don't get at least 1% of the vote for Ken in this election, we lose our minor party status in the state. That's the law. So we would lose and that means that people across the state would lose the ability to register green unless they're you know, certain localities. So Ken Krajewski for Attorney General. And again, thanks for having me on.
Justin, much appreciated. We thank you for coming in.